Welcome to Intelligent Systems, the podcast of the Institute for Intelligent Systems at the University of Memphis. I'm your host, Dr. Leah Windsor. I'm the director of the Institute for Intelligent Systems and an associate professor of applied linguistics at the University of Memphis. I study language and society. My work explores the question, how does what we say reveal who we are? In this podcast, we will explore the dynamics of intelligent systems, including interactions between and among humans, computers, and groups of sentient and non-sentient beings. The Institute for Intelligent Systems has three key areas: language, learning, and artificial intelligence. We will explore and define what an intelligent system is and talk about intelligent systems in practice across these three issue areas. Today's guest is Dr. Michael Colarisi. Michael Colarisi is an Associate Vice Provost for Data Science and leads the Responsible Data Science Initiative at the University of Pittsburgh. He is the William S. Dietrich II, Professor of Political Science, Assistant Director of the Center for Research Computing, and Co-Founding Director of the Interdisciplinary Computational Social Science Major. Dr. Colarisi is joining us today to give the public lecture for our cognitive science seminar on the psychology of digital media literacy. Welcome to the Intelligent Systems Podcast, Mike.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's so wonderful to have you back, because you were here in 2019, giving such an interesting, like, you just...
That was a fun time.
That was really fun.
Yeah, that was a great group. Yeah, people have talked about how I have much to look up to because of the previous speakers, which I'm sure I do. But this group of seminar students also has something to live up to because the discussion was lovely.
Okay.
Right, like last time too.
Yeah, fingers crossed. You know, everything's a little off post-pandemic, you know. And we have people joining remotely to the seminars. But I'm sure it'll be a good discussion.
I'm excited.
Yes. Okay, so tell us a little bit about yourself. I'm always so curious about people's academic stories and...
Yeah, I guess you learn a lot about, like, where they even start. Like, how do they answer that question?
Yeah, right.
So maybe I'll start, like, with how normally I start with things. It's, like, what I'm embarrassed about.
Oh.
So I would say I started my career as a relatively traditional political scientist and international relations scholar, at least my... you know, like, academic career.
Okay.
And I was really always interested in war and conflict. And I think, you know, we're thinking about intelligent systems, right?
Yeah.
So war is a system and the multi-scale aspects of it. And it seemed like something that was very complex, but you could still say something about.
Yes.
And so I was always interested in this idea of the sort of individual, group, international, like, resolutions and aspects of it.
Yeah.
But I quickly learned that political science really wanted you to sort of pick a resolution, right? Pick a specific question, right? And run with that.
Right.
And, you know, I had a very, very helpful, good advisor, right, to teach me both how to do that, but who also sort of saw things in macro and meso. And so while I think I started out, like, relatively traditional in studying sort of war and rivalries and where that came, all things that are coming back now,
right?
There was, like, a decade where people were like, why would you study international conflict?
Like,
and they're now like, why aren't you talking more about international conflict?
Right.
You know, of these things. But I also had the seed planted, like, my advisor, like, Bill Thompson, right, that there were other ways to look at things, you know, and I really appreciated that. And it's particularly, like, as my career went forward, it was just, like, learning new things, right? Discovering computer science was a big deal to me and things that were outside of political science.
Yeah.
You know, we were really lucky to have a methodology sequence at Indiana that pulled you out of political science. So they were just sort of friends in psychology and political science and psychology and economics that knew that they all taught cool stuff and wanted all their students to take. So I took, you know, Scott Long taught a class in sociology for all of us, and John Williams taught a class in political science, and it got you out of your silo. And that has always stayed with me, that there was so much sort of outside of your discipline, right, to learn and engage with. And I've just tried to always, when I could, you know, sort of relook, like, what are the things I don't know that I'm super excited about? And so...
Yeah.
You know, data science is really like, I don't think, like, when I started my career, I was a traditional IR person, and now I lead a responsible data science initiative, which is a very social science kind of take on it, but is also incredibly interdisciplinary, you know, and data specific. So I've bridged into computational social science, I feel like has been an umbrella that I've been very happy to be underneath. you know, for this, that there's a sort of multidiscipline that's grown up, that is at the intersection of social sciences and computation that I like really value. And so that's a little bit about me, is sort of like finding that like home for exploration and, you know, it being okay, you don't know the answer, and being a little weird, right? And like, that's been really important to me.
Right now, like if, when people ask me, like what field I'm in, I say computational social science because there's not one bucket, right? And it sounds like your experience in Indiana really is kind of an informal setup for what the IIS is, like getting people to take each other's classes and talk to each other. And I've been doing some work in the last couple of years on research teams and collaboration and just how to get over the vernacular hurdle with people, because sometimes you use the same word for different things and different words for the same things, and you have, you know, sociology theories that are the same as political science theories, but they're just described a little differently across, you know, all the social sciences and humanities. And actually, really, I think it encompasses the physical sciences too. I mean, because there are I've ended up talking about the wave particle duality in my graduate linguistics survey of linguistics class. You know, like there's insights from everywhere. Everything's everything.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Like, we'll maybe like get to what I'll talk about today, like in the lecture. But like physics, like actually plays a role in like analog physics, like versus digital, is like super different things. But it's obviously like, you know, natural sciences are a huge part of that that I don't know a ton about, right? But I think there's like a useful intuition, like from, you know, their exploration and discovery that we need to pay attention to.
Yes. And I think part of the reason why we like TED Talks so much is that they talk to us in smart and understandable ways. And I love when research teams can get to that level. And, you know, some people are just automatically really good at it. But the cross-disciplinary stuff, even if you've got different people working on the same project from different perspectives, if they're just looking at it from their perspective and not somebody, like, you can all be working on the same problem and collaborating, but not seeing things differently, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. I just wanted to add, I think, like, my best meetings have been interdisciplinary, and my worst meetings like, have been interdisciplinary, too. And it really gets at this, both, like, sort of language, right, and your kind of empathy for what you know or don't know. So the worst meetings are always, like, people that, like, you're not using those words right. Like, you're not speaking my language, therefore you don't understand and don't have anything to add to this. And the best meetings are, like, listening, you know, and everybody being open to not having the answer, but having some common, like, thread. And there's a science of this now. Like, Scott Page's work, right, on diversity and the wisdom of the crowds, and the sort of two ideas that you actually have, you absolutely have to have these different perspectives, but also a sort of common core that you're focused on. Like, just adding different perspectives doesn't always lead to better solutions.
Right.
You have to be pointed at the right thing. You have to have some angle, literally, like geometrically, like a new angle, right? Like on the problem, right? That help us encompass, right, this complex truth in this high dimensional space. But if you have both of those things, it's amazing.
And I think probably the meetings that go bad, people get furious and not curious, and the meetings where they go well, people get curious about, like, hey, you just used that word, this means something in my field, and there's like this really dynamic reconciliation of ideas. And I've learned so much about art history and physics and things that I never would have thought to apply to international relations,
Just going on that too, I mean, I do think computational social science's strength is that name a problem that isn't interdisciplinary today.
Right.
I mean, there is the need, you know, to study complexity, yes. and different perspectives yeah. and sort of multi-scale and, you know, multidisciplinary
yes.
innovations and understandings about, you know, everything from like yeah. climate change to computing to right, information systems yep. and the future of democracy and what the heck's going on in yeah. the international world and how do we handle tariffs and like what is this? Like
right.
it's all interdisciplinary,
it is.
Right, in these really important ways. Yeah. And computational social science gives us a name in some sense that is, you know, a tent that's
yeah.
big enough,
right,
for these different perspectives, I think, that also
yes.
centers people,
yeah.
you know, in that,
yes.
along with computation together.
Yes. Yes.
Right, kind of equally, and I think that's really important. It's like two words, but they come second, and computation is first, and that evens out.
Yeah.
So I think we're okay.
It, like, satisfies everybody's, you know, disciplinary ego needs.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was ahead of thought, and now it's gone. Anyway, welcome to my world.
I know the feeling.
Okay, so you're giving this talk today at our cognitive science seminar. Can you give us a little preview about what you're going to talk about?
Sure. So I was told the seminar is largely about sort of systems of like mis disinformation and
yes.
like understanding that.
Yes.
And so my talk's a very macro discussion of this.
Love
so
it.
I kind of want to talk about the world politics of information. That's
that.
What my talk's about.
Okay.
And in particular, like my like sort of two puzzles I want to talk about. So one puzzle is, you know, democracies have done pretty well over the last like 50, 60, 70
yeah.
years, but we're worried about them now.
Right.
So that's sort of one related puzzle,
yeah.
Is what happened that made democracy successful when people like Walter Lippmann would have said years ago that we're doomed
right.
because we don't have more centralized control.
Right.
And people like Dewey, right, would say like, you know, us pooling our resources and learning from each other and investing in education and sort of liberal modes
John
of understanding.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yes.
Right. Like we're going to move,
yeah.
you know, we're going to move forward. This thing's going to work.
Yes.
Right. But if you take either one of those perspectives, the arc doesn't make sense.
Yes.
Like, of this original success is a puzzle to one.
Yeah.
And the worries, and I think the reasons,
yeah.
we have reasons to worry today,
yeah.
right, on the other side don't necessarily make sense from the sort of Deweyan, like,
yeah.
perspective. And I think what we're missing, like, in this, and what my talk's about is the second puzzle,
mm-hmm.
Which is about how things have changed
mm-hmm.
in what I will call sort of the information communication and computational technologies of our time
okay.
and why we've missed that. And so, and in fact, we don't even have a word for it, right? We, when we talk about ICT, we talk about information communication technology as
right.
just, they're just networks and
right.
like information just flows. But I think the second C is really important,
yeah.
that there's actually the computation of
oh,
signals
yeah.
that literally transmutes information from one state to another.
Right.
And so the second puzzle is why do we think that the social media
mm-hmm.
is worrisome or exciting,
yeah.
right? Like changes in the infosphere,
right?
Like have, I think, important meaning.
Yeah.
And I think the solution to one is the solution to the other. And so like my
that's
talk is really about how Web 2.0 plus or whatever you want
right.
to call it is an illusion. It doesn't look anything like sort of analog world that democracy sort of matured into
yeah.
from the 40s right
yeah.
up until like the early 2000s
yeah.
like maybe, and that things that we have a hint are different, like ad tech, right, and surveillance tools that are under the hood
right.
Are a really important part of the information computation architecture that
yeah.
we can't see very well
yeah.
but actually are foundational to how systems of governance work.
Yeah.
And then we'll use that to better understand how democracy used to function, things that we took for granted in an analog world
yes.
that allowed democracy to socially learn and solve problems
yes.
that are actually no longer true given our current information substrate
yes.
that empowers different things, and why that actually empowers autocracies more than democracies when analog was the flip side of that.
Yes.
And how I think that helps explain the tension between where we thought we were going and where we are, right, as well as different trajectories of sort of institutions internationally.
Wow. I had not thought about it like that, like this maturation or developmental, like human growth and development in terms of democracies, that modern democracies grew up in the analog age. And so if this were the analogy of the human developmental lifespan, where would you put us now? Is this like the awkward teenage years? Is this like,
no? So I think that's
midlife
where the
crisis.
Yeah, I think that's where the analogy falls off.
Because, okay.
Like in some sense, we of humans up till now have evolved, right? Mostly in an analog world.
Yeah.
And I think the digital future is not going to look, right, particularly like the analog past. And it really depends on us, like what we build, right? Who controls what tools, what's private and what's not, who has agency,
yes,
right, is going to be really crucial. And
yes,
those things weren't problems before. They in the same way. So it's not that agency wasn't a problem. It's like, it's not that we always knew the truth.
Right.
It's that nobody controlled the source code. So the title of the talk is, you know, about changing the source code of world politics. And the rules of physics literally didn't, like, nobody had control over those. You know, like, we all played by the same rules.
Yeah.
That's not true in the digital world.
True.
Right? Like, he controls, you know, the user interface and what happens with the data.
Yeah.
And the networked privacy has very different affordances.
Yes.
Than the person that's trapped on the wrong side of the screen and thinks, you know, they're exploring or on a safari or at the edge, right? When really it's someone else that's in control of all of these things and what they're doing and what they know. So that's...
And it all kind of goes back to, like, very basic philosophy about free will and, and agency.
And so I think that's what empowers autocracies now also.
Yeah.
Is, you know, democracies I see as a system of social learning.
Yeah.
That we have to solve problems, but it's through consent.
Right.
And there's this nice transaction that should happen, sort of in equilibrium, where people provide resources at consent, but the government, right, provides solutions.
Right.
And is accountable, right, for those solutions, but you have to know what they are. You have to learn new information over time.
Right.
Like to be able to hold leaders to account, to know whether delivering solutions and the world's dynamic and changing.
Yeah.
You know, as we're seeing, autocracy is a different system. It's still information-based, but the transaction is fear-based as opposed to social learning, you know, where there's repression, you know, and in exchange, you know, there are, like, resources and things that are collected, you know, by the autocrat and leader.
Yeah.
And the analog, so analog technology is difficult in some sense for repression and for what you need in the informational sense, so.
Yes. So, in a case like North Korea, for example, do you think that the digital age and the diffusion of online access, whether it's, you know, through illicit networks or, you know, however, you know, people get their the cell phones that they're not supposed to have or whatever, do you think that this new information age 2.0 can be like a wedge or a an entry point for autocracies or
An entry point for autocracies or for, like, sort of liberal ideas to make it into right,
like,
the populace's, like, understanding and perspective?
Right, so it's like kind of going in. It's the same thing doing different things in different places. So it's doing different things to democracy, but how do you see it playing out in super closed authoritarian regimes?
Yeah, so I'm not an optimist, like, on this at all. So I do think, like, Web 1.0, right, technologies that were, you know, so when, like, HTML and the web was text-based and you were sharing messages and it was much more sort of one-way communication.
Right.
That looks a lot more like analog, you know, technology.
Right.
JavaScript is just different, right? It's actually hard to come up with. So JavaScript is, like, for those that don't know, kind of the language of the web. It's a reactive programming language. It's actually pretty hard to come up with physical, like, analog analogies for JavaScript. Because, you know, there's a code base that's not really running on your machine, but you're interacting with. So you're seeing reactions from it, but you're not actually, like, in control and don't have visibility of why, right, those reactions are happening. Plus, it can change, right? So someone else is potentially in control, right, at the server side, like, of what's going on. And so it's actually much more like pre-scientific understanding where, like, the world is trying to trick you, right? Like, there are gods out there, and they change the rules.
I was just going to go there. Yeah. Like, this is religion, too.
It's a little like that, except it's not necessarily religious, and it seems like a conspiracy, right? But, like, no, it's just the code base of the world, right? The way we've organized this information infrastructure. And so I'm not optimistic about it, because largely the people that control these things, right, have more information than you do. Yeah. And even them giving you the affordance to be able to do that, if they can spy on you doing that, right, means that they're always a step ahead of you with this. And so digitally savvy autocracies, and I'm not saying all autocracies are digitally savvy, right, it's never been a better time to be a dictator. because of the information that you can collect, like, centrally and compute and analyze, to make people afraid, as well as disrupt any challenges to your regime and pick and choose, like, and optimize, you know, when to intervene and publicly, privately, like, or whatever. And part of it's because people don't understand how the system works, and they think that, oh, we're going to organize online and this is going to be really empowering, but when the authorities are watching, like, you've just revealed your hand, and, like, maybe they don't arrest you because it's useful for you to go protest and cause, right? And then, you know, they infiltrate the group and there's violence, right? So they have a way of choosing different policies that in the analog world would have been very difficult, right, for them to be able to actualize.
Or they just let you blow off steam and it's a safe, you know,
exactly.
Because, you know, in democracies, protest is a generally protected activity, and so it should be non-threatening because it's part of the fabric of, you know, how governance works.
And I think what's actually happening is a set of sort of different things in different places, that same sort of disruption of dissent is coming home to the U.S., to democracies in particular.
Yeah.
That what we're seeing is techniques of disruption in autocracies can actually be used transnationally in democracies and influence campaigns and other things. So part of the work is actually showing how just disruption, right, of social learning in democracies is now much easier, partly because of surveillance, right, and ad tech tools, right, that allow narrow casting of messages to people, which just wasn't really possible because ICCT was different, the information, communication, computation technologies.
So what is this doing in places like North Korea? Like, what's the, like, the democratic space, I understand. How do you see it playing out in closed authoritarian regimes?
So when they're digitally savvy,
like,
I think the survival of those regimes is going to continue, like, much past, like, what we would have forecast, you know, like, 10, 15 years ago.
Right.
In the ones that aren't digitally savvy. So, and but digitally savvy, I should define. So I don't actually just look at a social media, right? It's about closed circuit TV. It's about drones, right? It's about, like, do you have machine learning engineers, you know, like, that are actually, like, looking at the millions of signals? You know, are you doing data science for autocracy?
Right.
Like, in some really awful, but unfortunately, like, realistic way. So do you have the input signals from all of these things? And then think
and
about biometrics.
System.
All of, like, So identification, lack of privacy, knowing people's thoughts or inferring and guessing. With, you don't have to be perfect, right? Like, the precision and, like, F1 scores, right, don't matter as long as you stay in power, you know, like, for this. So that's what I, like, meant, you know, in that space.
So it's just going to be more stable and less disruption.
I think for right now, like, if we don't change the underlying technologies, or another way to, like, say it is Silicon Valley, right, has, in some sense, like, lowered the barrier to being a dictator because of these tools that are available. And we see this in technologies in China in particular and in Russia,
right,
that have kind of Western origin. That wasn't intended. No one meant for that to happen. But it gets to this idea of it's a complex system and there are unintended consequences, like, of technology and information and how they intersect with people. Subsidized was the word I was looking for. It's been subsidizing. Like, this kind of digitally savvy dictatorship.
So what is the takeaway message from your talk today?
We need to build different platforms and tools.
Okay.
That privacy, I think, is really, really important.
Okay.
And, you know, for this. And so part of what we do is we build an agent-based model
right.
that has, you know, sort of tries to mimic analog communication among communities
right.
and then different social media platforms. I'm talking with my hands a lot, which on a podcast, right, like doesn't really translate.
That's fine.
But I haven't hit a microphone or anything yet. So I feel like we're in a good place here.
We used to do the podcast over in an official setup, but like you got to go over there and do the whole, you know, this is like only murders in the building style is easier. So gesticulate wildly. Imagine Mike Colarisi gesticulating wildly here.
Yeah, I lost my train of thought thinking about not knocking over microphones, though.
I remembered what I was going to ask you,
please,
though, or tell
yeah.
you. We had Roman Yampolsky here last fall, and he was one of the folks that signed on to, what was it called, like the memo or whatever about AI governance,
mm-hmm.
And how troublesome it is that there's a lack of AI governance, that we let AI write its own code and
yeah.
things like this.
Yeah, yeah. We were talking about, like, what's a take-home message?
Yes,
and
thank
it was
you.
About sort of privacy
yes.
and agency.
Yes.
So I just think we need to build these kind of tools in. People need
yes.
to understand. I mean, universities have a huge role to play. I think
yeah.
we dropped the ball for the last 10 years in telling people that a browser was a tool they could use and wasn't a tool that used them. Or at least understanding what it was. I have really, really smart students in computational social science come to my classes thinking they totally understand the way that social media, that they're in control of messages on social media. And by the end of a 2-lecture series, they're like super mad at me because I don't have a solution. And they're like, I'm not in control at all. Like all this happens.
Yeah.
Right. And like, it's even simple. Like everyone listening, go to Google, type a letter into the search bar. It'll start propagating things that clearly it knows where you are.
Yeah.
Right? And so how did it, like, wait, where did it go? Because in your mind, you think I typed the letter P, right? And it went to the keyboard, and then it went to the memory, and maybe it went to, like, one server and pinged back. But that's not what happened, right? Like, in fact, it knew where your cursor was. It knew you were clicking in here, right? And the information is everywhere, right? All at once being used by data aggregators. And once you show people, right, this opaque ecosystem, of
yeah.
information that they don't see,
yeah.
it freaks them out.
Yeah.
And so, like, we need to tell people about it and educate them on what's happening.
Right.
And then we also need to be building the infrastructure, you know, to provide and protect important principles.
Mm-hmm. So that really fits well within the intelligent ecosystems, too, that intelligent ecosystems would have a system of governance and guardrails and guidelines, transparency. You know, my trifecta for good policy is clearly communicated, transparent, equitably applied.
Mm-hmm.
And I also really love the saying that if something is free, you're the product.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And yeah. I think that we don't remember that enough about the internets.
yeah, I totally agree. And
yeah.
I think, I do think AI is both a challenge and an opportunity.
Yes.
So we can think about, like, every time you're using a chatbot,
yeah.
that's like a browser.
Yeah.
It's an illusion.
Yeah.
Right? You're,
yeah.
you know, like, in some sense, you know, that's a product. I like to say OpenAI is a data science company where AI is the product.
Yeah.
Right? Not the other way around. And
yeah.
if you forget that,
yes.
you know, you're disempowering both yourself and your organization
right.
for what you can produce and the value. So getting away
yeah.
from dependence on that.
Yeah.
That only they could produce AI. Actually, like, yes, they have billions of dollars and it's, like, smartly
yeah.
done, but it's data
yeah.
and it's people and it's a system that processes that, like, into a product.
Yeah.
And I do think we have an opportunity to teach people how to use breakthroughs in neural networks to add value the way they want to.
Yeah.
To do AI verification. Like, there's, I think there can be a very rich future of decentralized agency, like, confidence
yeah.
and leadership, like, in this area. But universities sort of have to step up and partner and be part of that solution.
Yeah. And I just reflecting on, like, all of the nouns that we have used in this, like, the general understanding about neural networks or machine learning or artificial intelligence or generative AI, I think everybody thinks they know what it is,
mm-hmm.
but it's hard to put your finger on it if somebody tells you to define it. And you certainly, I don't think most people reflect on the ways that it actually influences their life or their life influences that in the recursive system. Yeah. You know, but I think maybe I'm pessimistic about this too, because higher education is having, you know, a crisis right now. And so, you know, like there's a crisis in confidence in higher education, but also like this research ecosystem and teaching system still exist. And so is there a way for higher education to be relevant in this moment where there's not a lot of confidence mm-hmm. in us?
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah. So I think absolutely. I mean, this I am optimistic about, honestly.
Okay.
Like, so I do think the recognition
okay.
that universities are challenged,
okay.
like the fact that universities are feeling like the old model of
yeah.
what has been done doesn't seem to be working. Now, people might not like it,
right?
They might not be comfortable with that.
Yes.
They might really like how things have been going, and
yes.
they don't want to change. But I see a general recognition
okay.
that something needs to change. And so I was just sharing with someone earlier today, you know, I think a year or two ago, I would give a talk to faculty, and
mm-hmm.
I would say, you need to be listening to companies in what you teach. Like,
yeah.
your students need jobs.
Yeah.
And you need to update your syllabi, your, you know, learning objectives for programs,
right.
and it should happen closer to quarterly, right, than it does, like, every decade.
Interesting.
You know, that's what needs to happen
okay.
for all of us. Now, I work in, like, technology spaces, so
yeah.
that's maybe a little bit faster.
Yeah.
But, like, we have an advisory board that's amazing of 13 companies, and we set up because we need to listen to them.
Yeah.
And so we need to be not the ivory tower. We need to be a really big ear, right, that can listen
yes.
to what's going on, like,
yes.
what do they need,
flipping the script
and
there.
Put it into curriculum as fast as possible, and then getting feedback, like
yes.
are our students doing it for you? I mean, we heard in data science that it was taking them a year to get students, not just from Pitt, right, all over,
yeah.
you know, a year to be useful in driving value in their companies or in the city of Pittsburgh, like whatever it is. There was
right.
so much training that had to get done
right.
because data is not abstract, right?
Yeah.
The models and the decisions are very embodied and contextual.
Yes. Yes.
And we had been teaching, and I think this is true in the AI space
yeah.
to some extent, like we had been teaching this abstract math and coding as if the view from nowhere was the view from everywhere. And those are two completely different things. So the view from nowhere,
yes.
like think about is like every tech picture online,
yeah.
where it's like glowing blue with a black background.
Yes.
And
right.
And we sort of think like if
cosmic
you,
or something.
Yeah, like
yeah.
if you code, you transcend, right? All
right.
the places, like the, all
right.
the messiness around. Like,
right.
no.
Right.
That abstraction is super useful in silico, right? Like when we do
yeah.
collect data and have models, like, we can transform information in really, really important ways.
Yes.
But if the data didn't come from anywhere of value,
yeah.
and we don't do something with it to make it valuable in the real world, that doesn't matter. And
this is why we need social scientists
yeah.
in the mix alongside data scientists, because the social scientists are going to help drive the why questions
mm-hmm.
and the policy outcomes, and the data is... not useful in a void, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, like, that's why, like, so we, you know, it's a responsible data science initiative,
yes.
and responsibility is about applied use.
Yes.
And it's not just in the abstract. And I actually think, like, social scientists are super important in this. They're
yes.
so important, actually. If social scientists don't engage with this, what happens is computer science and information science just grows their own. Because
yeah.
they still need to deal with people.
Yeah.
And so computational social science, as you know, can live in very different
yes.
places at a university,
yes.
because if the social science don't engage in this process,
yes.
Well, we need it. And so it has to grow somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think at the university level, one of the pain points for doing this kind of work is T&P committees.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, I think maybe we're like on the cusp of getting to a good place where it's not just about like, did you have 10 publications, you know, in the last 6 years or whatever? You know, altmetrics have been, used more frequently and
mm-hmm.
carry more weight in some places, but not in all. And so, you know, just something as simple as changing the incentive structures for what people do. You know, I love the saying, boring is best. Like, it's
mm-hmm.
just... change how T&P committees evaluate. You know, when you're talking about when you got started and, you know, political science, I think still is, like, very siloed and binned. You know, if you co-author with someone, you and I had this discussion, like, over a decade ago, I'm recalling now, that is it counted as half a publication? If you co-author with a graduate student, like, do you get a quarter of the publication? If you have 10 co-authors, you know, does that even count? And I was literally just texting yesterday with a colleague out west who wants to go up for full and has papers in, like, widely recognized prestigious journals, but they are interdisciplinary, co-authored, and was told, like, they don't count. Yeah. And it just does not compute.
Yeah, I want to add a layer of tragedy to this.
Yes.
So all across the university, there are people with amazing ideas.
Yes.
That, like, have social impact.
Yes.
That, like, are going to be important to solving policy problems.
Yes.
Most of them are interdisciplinary because that's the world we live in.
Right.
They're not doing those things. Why? Why don't they do that project that they're excited about, or they're jealous that someone else has started and they think they have a unique take on? Like, because the disciplinary incentives,
yeah,
right, aren't set up. But how do universities get ahead? If you're Pitt or you're Memphis and you want to attract more students and more research funding and more partners, right, yeah, outside an industry, you got to do the next thing. You got to do the little bit high risk, right, yeah, but really exciting. You got to solve transformative problems and not just talk about it.
Yeah.
And so this is the tragedy, is the universities have an incentive,
yeah,
to bend,
yeah,
right, what people are,
right,
doing, to,
right,
do the next thing,
yeah,
to let them take the risk, not just exploit what they already know they can do,
yes,
but do the next thing that is going to be super exciting. And even if 1 in 10, 1 in 20 pay off, right,
yeah,
it's transformative for the university.
For
so
sure.
One of the best things the University of Pittsburgh did was several years ago was an edict saying interdisciplinary counts and disciplines for tenure and promotion. Full
it.
Stop. You have to count it, right? And I think every university absolutely has an imperative, like, needs to do that. It doesn't say your disciplinary stuff doesn't count.
Right.
It just means there's multiple pathways to,
yes,
making a contribution. And disciplines, like, are important. I say that because people are listening.
Yeah.
right? But there are other ways of adding value, right,
yes,
to our organization and our society that,
yeah,
like, need to count.
And I think, you know, the metaphor of pie, like, if you look at a publication as a pie and you've got 10 co-authors and 10 slices of pie, like, you did a tenth of the work, whereas you could think of it as being like, I did 100% of the work that I contributed to on this paper, and even more than that, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's much harder to work with large teams, and especially across disciplines. So yeah, I mean, universities should incentivize,
yeah,
that.
And
it
the
sense.
Standardization of, like, every, you know, publication is a pie, right? This literally,
yes,
fixed, like, what we're saying is it's a private good.
Yeah.
And we're using a private good analogy for something that's actually, like, a public or at least a club good.
For sure.
Right, like, for this. And so, you know, I just think about it as, like, it's an economy.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, we're all contributing in connected ways.
Yes.
That doesn't mean there's not value that we have to place on certain things.
Right.
But it's not as simple as dividing by the number of co-authors.
No,
you
that's
know?
Right.
And we
that's
shouldn't,
right.
And we should look at people's trajectories and careers,
yes,
and not the atoms, right, that sort of make,
yes,
up the compound,
yes,
that, you know, contribute,
exactly,
you know, to the material, right,
yeah,
that is, like, our knowledge fabric. Like, it's...
And I feel like universities tried this maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago when cluster hires were the thing. But it's hard with the cluster hires if you have to satisfy requirements in two different disciplines. Mm-hmm. And, like, the idea was there, but the implementation was not... didn't match the intention.
Yeah,
of it.
I agree. I mean, I do think that was... I think there are solutions to that, right?
Okay.
Like a tenure home in one place, even,
yeah,
if your effort is split.
Yes.
You know,
like,
that,
yeah,
that,
yes,
is possible. I also think sort of having different jobs in a university,
yeah,
where there are sort of research scientists,
yeah,
you know, as first-class citizens, that teaching and clinical scholars are first-class citizens, instead of that there's one mode of professor that sort of must do everything. It's a very discipline-specific mode, I think, and vision for that. And in sort of the knowledge economy that we have today, I think there's much more specialization and hence, you know, parts that need to connect, you know, that we need to honor their contributions.
I really hope that the culture of gatekeeping and like insular knowledge communities, I hope that people can relax into less anxiety about doing this, and I wish everyone would just relax about it, you know? Like, it would be so nice if the system were less anxious, if we were more curious and less defensive about it.
There's an insecurity, I think.
Oh, for sure.
And I think part of that comes from when you're disconnected from reality and there's no way to measure, in some sense, did you actually make an impact or not? Like, did you help someone, like, or not? Like, well, the insecurity comes from a real place. You don't know. And so we fall back on other metrics, like, or things. And I do think practical impact is something. Is basic science is super important. But honestly, a lot of basic science often has a metric. Like, you're solving a puzzle that we can agree, like, you solved or didn't solve.
Right.
Even if it's not necessarily business value or other stuff.
Right.
But there's, you're still getting feedback from the world that this experiment worked.
Yes.
The things I worry the most about are things where we don't have that feedback. And I do think we need to organize our priorities around things where we can learn we're wrong and we're right, and and we can value learning we're wrong is still learning, and it's still a contribution, as long as you did it in a, you know, a disciplined, responsible, innovative, creative way, and, you know, honoring that. I think it, I think there's a pathway to it.
My fail harder t-shirt wasn't clean, so I couldn't wear it today.
You promised.
I know, I promised. I'm sorry. I'll have my daughter cricket you one. But yeah, like, embracing failure, like, it's like exciting. Like, what new way can I fail today?
Yeah.
You know, like, what interesting way? And you never know where on the arc you are of, you know, getting it. You know, the other thing that I think that's stuck back in the analog is that's the tension between maybe the physical sciences or computation and the social sciences and humanities, is that people who are in the humanities, even a lot of my political science colleagues are like, I got into this because I didn't want to do math, you know? And there's, like, people on the social sciences and humanities side, there's this affective wall about, like, I'm afraid to do math. I don't know what I don't know. I was never good at math, and or I was told I was never good at math. Like, if you had told me I would be doing any of this, like, a decade ago, shenanigans, no way. Yeah. Like, if I can do it, anyone can do it, you know? I don't have the innate math intuition, but that shouldn't stop you from going there, you know?
Yeah. And plus, you can also work with people. Like, you're hugely collaborative, right? So, you know, like, you know, it's really important to know, like, what you need to do to get your work done, who to talk to, right? And who to leverage to go far. Like, even Einstein needed collaborators for math.
For sure.
There's no harm in, like, you know, knowing that. And I think there's this imposter syndrome that we should really talk about math and coding and computation.
Yes.
And, like, it's not, it's again this sort of arms race, like, a little bit. Like, am I good enough? In what sense?
Like,
if computer scientists or physics aren't working on the thing you're working on, it doesn't matter. Yeah. They're not in the same race. Like, we're not going to get the knowledge that you are creating right now.
Right.
Without your, like, time and toil on it.
Yes.
And you shouldn't, like, that's amazing. That's your contribution. And we need to get more people to feel empowered, you know, in the direction. Like, do what you need to do to solve the problem.
Yeah. And I don't know exactly how to articulate it, but it feels like there's an asymmetry between, like, the work that social scientists and people in the humanities are doing, and maybe it's the value that's placed on that, that it's nice, or it's, you mm-hmm. know, like, how might Chaucer help us understand physics or something, right? Like, there's, it's a very old school ivory tower,
mm-hmm.
whereas the computational side and the technical side is venturing, like, full steam ahead into social science questions, but nobody's saying, like, but what about Chaucer, or what about mm-hmm. Shakespeare, or what about, like, poetry, yeah. or whatever,
so,
you know?
So I totally agree with you, and I've thought about this a lot, because I speak to, and I have some amazing colleagues in humanities and social scientists, but also computer science and engineering.
Same, yes.
And actually, like, there's the same problem that you mm-hmm. can see anywhere, and if you name it in the humanities and social sciences, they're kind of, like, shocked, but I think it's the same thing, so I'm going to try it out, even though we're recording.
Okay.
It's abstraction. People think of critical thinking as being a skill disembodied from context. They don't say it like that.
Right.
But, like, that's actually what they mean. Mm-hmm. So when you say, I'm teaching people critical thinking, in what context? Like, for what purpose? Like, how does it bounce off the world and tell you, like, whether it's out of bounds or in bounds?
Right.
They don't have an answer for that. And that's, for me, this problem and dysfunction with the ivory tower that's grown separate from and doesn't even reflect. Ivory doesn't reflect, does it? I don't know.
No.
Right? Like the outside world. It would be a better metaphor if it didn't.
The mirror tower?
Yeah, yeah. No, no, it doesn't. I don't want it to reflect.
Oh, okay.
Right? Like, it's like
translucent.
Opaque. Translucent. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Ephemeral.
But I see it in social science. I see it in the humanities.
Yeah.
We name it all the time in technical fields.
Yeah.
All the time we're saying you're abstracting, you're ripping things from their context, right? And just treating it as data, like, without dealing with the people.
Right.
But actually, we can do that with words just as easily.
Yeah.
And we can, and maybe have, like, abstracted away, right?
Yeah.
In many, many different, like, domains and disciplines.
Yes.
And so, we try to talk about it, responsible data science. It's critical thinking, communication, collaboration with and beyond data. It's not just critical thinking.
Yes.
It's not just data. You got to do it together. It's the intersection of these things on real world problems that we get from industry and other parts.
Right.
And I think that's the pathway forward on it. That's why I'm optimistic. We can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so final question. I think this is my favorite one. So what are you doing for fun these days, professionally or personally? And you mentioned this, like, I don't know if it's on here, the art theft on there. Like, I've got, when you said that last night, we didn't have a chance to tug on that thread. But in our family, we love there's a documentary about the Gardner Museum heist. There's the Spider-Man of Paris. Have y'all seen these?
No.
Oh my God. There's the diamond heist.
Okay.
It was in London, and there's, like, the True Spies podcast has art heist stuff and people from the FBI, you know, the art crimes. There's the art of the heist. That's probably not what you're doing for fun.
No.
But
is that what you do for fun? What do you do for fun? You have younger kids than me. I mean, it's both, in some sense, more fun. Sorry, teenager kid coloreses. But, yeah.
What do I do for fun? I love walking the dog.
Uh-huh.
Love it. I love working with the chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like doing physical things that
make
me physically tired.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Farming, gardening.
So that's similar, like, to me.
Okay.
Like, where, so I played tennis growing up, like, for a long time, and I don't play as much as I do, but I play more now than I, like, used to.
Okay.
And then, like, just sort of, like, working out. So one of my sons, Rose, and so I got into erging as, like, an don't have a lot of time, but it's a super efficient way.
The
rowing machine thing.
Yeah.
Not at home. Like,
I
don't have one, but just things I don't have to think about, admin, and, like, work, you know? But it is, like, exhausting in a very, you know, really good way.
Yes.
That helps me, like, recharge.
Yeah.
And, like, I wish I had just... So I stopped doing sort of that stuff for a long time.
Yeah.
But I remember I was in this big grant boot camp that the research office ran.
Okay.
And one of the things that was really surprising to me, so they parade, they just make you feel awful about yourself. Don't go to these. Like, don't. It's just like all the most successful people from the university about how they have millions of dollars when you've like just been rejected from everything. I mean, it was awful, right?
Oh, no.
Like, it was just like, you know, self-confidence super low.
Yeah.
And they're all like, you know, they're all smart. Right, they're all nice,
yeah.
Darn it, right? Like, they all
you
have happy
dog.
Yeah, right. Like, they're just super lovely people.
Yes.
They're just better on every dimension
right.
than I am. But one thing I noticed is that they were whole people, right? So when you talk to them about what they do,
yeah.
they all have hobbies that they're deep in. Like, their work
yeah.
isn't their life,
yeah.
right? And that balance and seeing that,
yeah.
and actually as, like, looking around the university, and you say over and over again, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yes.
But how do you survive? That's not a strategy
right.
for training.
Right.
That's an observation.
Right.
Right. The strategy, I think, is like you have to do things you love. Right.
Yes.
Like you have to recharge your batteries.
Yeah.
And so the things that recharge my batteries, right, are a little bit. So hiking, traveling,
yes.
like I
yes.
love travel.
Yes.
It's really, really important to me.
Yeah.
You know, like doing some of the like erging and stuff just daily,
yeah.
like to recharge and then learning new things. Like, so every
totally.
Once in a while in my career, I'm just like, I don't know this. I'm just going to spend some time learning this new thing.
Yes.
Like, and so, you know, challenges for me, like math is kind of fun.
Yeah.
Right. So like,
yeah.
what's this new, you know, part of like computer science or software,
yes.
like, or machine learning that I can dig into.
Yeah.
I love that. And I love that about our job, right? That,
yes.
I mean, it doesn't always feel like we can, but we can, once we give ourselves permission
mm-hmm.
right, to do it, like we can.
Yes. And the thing that I, sometimes struggle with I think about it more as work-life boundaries
mm-hmm.
and like leaving work at work and but some of the things that I'm interested in professionally I'm also interested in personally
mm-hmm.
too and so yeah I mean maybe that's if it gets too onerous or challenging or unfun outside of work, like maybe that's time to put it away. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, the learning new things, absolutely. And the next time we get together, we should play tennis.
All right. Yeah,
yes.
yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a treat.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
This was lovely.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
To learn more about the Institute for Intelligent Systems, please visit iis.memphis.edu. Theme music for the Intelligent Systems podcast was created by Jason David Cooper.